Okay, here we are on the tape again. I mentioned to you, or asked you about some of the people you served with, and most, one of them I remember was Leland Carr. How about some of the other justices? Oh, Harry Kelly. I understand you had sort of a fondness for Harry Kelly.
Yeah, I had a particular fondness for Kelly, and it started off in an unusual fashion. I came to the court, you know, remembering really the bitter gubernatorial campaign of 1950, I think it was, in which Harry Kelly was running against me. And Williams, my old friend and political saint, and as I saw it most times, and I came prepared not to be particularly fond of Mr. Kelly, because of some of the rather harsh things he had said about my friend Mr. Williams during the 1950 campaign. But I found, not long after I got to the court, that Harry was not as I thought he was. He was a conservative guy. He sure had his sense of values, and he had this tremendous experience growing out of his age. And oh, he had been in World War I. He lost a leg in combat in World War I, and he had come through the wars in Illinois, where he was from, I think Ottawa, Illinois, where incidentally he had known August Scholl, who was from the same town.
And Emil Lockwood, maybe.
Yeah, yes. So anyway, he had come here to practice law at his Detroit with his brothers, and he'd become Secretary of State and governor during the war years. And I found out he was a man who was full of happy memories about people and things, and irrespective of who they were. And he was a generous person in spirit. And
great family man, wasn't he?
Great family man, yes. I remember him saying at one point at the end of a conference when we had a long, tough couple of weeks of working, we were just chatting about little things. He said, next week I'm going to marry off my youngest child. He said, then I'll be through. He said, I don't want to share a stock or anything. I don't own anything but a little log cabin up off of Galen in a little house. He said, but I'm a rich man.
Did you visit him at his place in Gaylord?
Oh, yes, yeah. I'd go north. I'd ordinarily stop in. I'd called before, of course, and stop. But he had a place in town where he had his library, and he and his wife Ann lived there, and then he took me out one time out to his place on the lake where he had a log cabin, a very big one, which he had built way back when his kids were growing up, because I think he had six children, he and his wife did, and he had been there. He said, this is my Shangri-La, and he had pictures of himself in a boat on a little lake just out from the place, and it was a hunting club location just outside of Galen. But he was a wonderful fellow, straight arrow of soul. He did what he thought was right. He worked hard. He asked no quarter in terms of relief from his cases when he wasn't feeling well. And that was fairly often because he was getting up in years, and I think he was diabetic, and he had, of course, the leg was off, and he didn't always feel too well. But he would come to the sessions of court, and he would struggle up to that bench and sit there and listen and he would go out and do his work. He worked from his office at Galen.
In a sense, you were seatmates, weren't you?
Yeah, because I was a junior member of the court, I was supposed to sit on the end, and of course, it was more convenient for Harry to sit on the end because he had to get off from time to time. And so I sat in his old place, and he sat in mine, and I would often help him on and off. But more importantly, we had a good speaking relationship. And when we discussed the cases, I always was interested in what Harry had to say, because he had a lot of experience and he had a lot of good common sense, and I would like to hear what he had to say about anything before I made up my mind.
How about the famous Dutchman, Chief Justice Detmers? He was Chief Justice, was he not?
Yes, let me see. He had been Chief Justice. I think Leland Carr was Chief Justice when I got there, and Kavanaugh succeeded him, Thomas M. Kavanaugh. Well, John and I, of course, we both lived there in Lansing. We had adjoining offices, and so I visited with him. And I got to know him pretty well. He used to say I was born in Iowa, the Dutch community out there, and I was sent to either Calvin or Hope College, I forgot which one, to become a minister in the Lutheran Church. And I decided to become a lawyer because John came from that area of the state, and he had been attorney general, and he had been on the court for some time. As a matter of fact, I think Harry Kelly appointed both him and Carr to the court when Harry was governor, from 44 through 48, I think somewhere in there.
Now, was George Edwards on the court when you...
George was there when I arrived, and I always say that he took one look at me and decided to leave. Actually, I arrived in October, and George left it about first of the year, and what had happened was Jerry Cavanaugh had been elected mayor down in Detroit, and somehow they had an understanding that Cavanaugh wanted to appoint Edwards to become police commissioner because there was a tremendous issue of the treatment accorded black citizens in Detroit by the then organized and administered police department of the city of Detroit, which was considered to be heavy-handed and not really fair. And
George
left the court to become police commissioner of Detroit, later going on to the Sixth Circuit, of course, where he is now. But I was just absolutely stunned that when he came around to say that he was going to leave the court and go with the Kavanaugh administration as police commissioner. The very idea that somebody would leave the Michigan State Supreme Court and go to the city of Detroit police commissioner's job, just it was almost unbelievable to me. Nothing wrong with that job, just that it was a huge step down. And he said his mission was to prove that you could have vigorous law enforcement within the Constitution. And that was his mission, and boy, did he work at it. He campaigned as if he were running for office. He was not, but he really went around every place he could get access to give that message that a big city police department can stay within the Constitution and laws of the country and still be vigorous in the prosecution of criminals.
Well, he got the police department started in a direction.
Oh, yes. He made a lot of changes. The occasional resignation of some of the what were considered then as hardliners. I don't know about the merits of it, but he got, I believe, effective control of the top echelon of the police department and initiated a lot of changes in it. George was a great fellow for the causes, and he had great energy, of course.
Now, Ted Souris, was he also sitting when you arrived?
Yeah, Ted arrived, of course, in the early part of '60. He took John Volker's place, and I arrived in the latter part of '61, and of course, we were the baby judges, if you will. Ted was, I think Ted's about 2.5 years younger than I think I told you before, younger than I am. I was 39 when I arrived. I think Ted was about 36 going on 37 when I arrived. And Ted was, as I've often said, he was the single most effective justice on the court during my time. I think Ted, because of his very hard work, his very good mind, and his exquisite preparation of every motion, every application for leave, of every case, Ted probably changed more minds at the conference table. I know he did than any of us, and probably more than all of us combined over the period of time I was there, 5 years or so.
Was it because of his hard work or his sheer intellectual power or the
combination? It was a combination of both. Ted would take some obscure motion of somebody to do something, and it would look on the surface as like and maybe 100 others we had seen, because we did an awful lot of these things and had to do them very hurried, and because we had almost no staff. We were the staff at that time, that is, the justices were. And Chad would have it better prepared than most of us, nearly all of us. And sometimes we were headed in one particular direction. He said, well, just before you make up your mind or something like that, let me just speak to that for a moment. And he would say, well, this is not as it appears. It is something a little bit deeper than that. If you'll notice, there is a phrase here or a clause there. And he said, I think this is something we want to take another look at. My belief is that we should do this rather than what you're proposing in your motion to do. And we listened to the argument, and he was often persuasive, and we would say, well, that sounds pretty good, Ted, and we would change our minds. He was hardworking and innovative, and
he was a hard worker, was he?
Oh yes, everybody was, really, pretty much. Everybody worked pretty hard at it. As a matter of fact, the most undying impression I have of the court is something that happened, I think, the first month or so I was on the court. We were at the end. We were holding court through court in quarterly terms at that time. And that time we would have hearings once a quarter for usually a couple of weeks at a time. And we came to an end of the hearing session, which was about, 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And there was something that was brought up, and boy, we were all tired. We'd been listening to, 6-7 arguments a day, 5 days a week, for 2 weeks, for 10 days, and we were all wanting to go back home and get out of there. We were just tired. Mm-hmm. And George Edwards had not left the court at that time, so it had to be before the end of 1961, and he said, I'll wait just a minute. He said, I don't think we should leave until we decide this. And he was insistent that we take this matter up, even though we were tired, and make a judgment about it before we left. And he was so insistent, everybody who was getting up to leave sat back down sort of resignedly and took up the matter late in the afternoon or early evening, and spent another half hour or so that we would not have spent at that time resolving the matter.
Now, you also served with Paul Adams and Thomas Matthew Kavanaugh.
Yeah, I think, and Michael Harrow.
And Michael Harrow. Yeah.
Well, Thomas Matthew had, I guess I would call, the instinct for justice. He had a feel for things. Tom could read the facts of a case and pretty much tell from the way things were arrayed as to what he thought was just or unjust about the situation. His bias, if you will, was in favor of the little guy, and I think he came by it honestly, and I think he was pretty consistent in his approach to it. In the great contest between man versus man and man versus institutions, I think Kavanaugh felt most keenly about the little guy, about him getting hurt in the melee and not being able to get justice, and I think he was very sensitive to that.
How long did you serve with Mike O'Hara? He came on toward the end, did he?
Now, Mike was in that election of 62, running against Paul Adams, and he defeated Paul in the spring election of, no, the fall election of 62, and therefore he unseated Adams. Mike came on the court first of 63, which was about, 14 months after I arrived there, and he moved from Menominee, Michigan, where he lived, down to Detroit, and he moved in the same neighborhood that I lived in. I had moved into just about a year earlier. And we became neighbors and good friends and discussants. We'd be arguing when we left the chambers of the court. We'd go home in our separate vehicles, and I'd stop by very often by his place because it was on the way to my home. And I'd stop in for an hour or so, and we'd continue the discussion very often. Mike had the fine balance between what people call the liberal and the conservative philosophies. And he loved to write. Mike really loved language. He loved the sound of words and the
embellishment. Word.
Yes, and he liked to put his Irish soul into the opinions. And he did. If you read his stuff, it's poetic to some extent. It's a lyrical and poetic kind of opinions.
Now, Paul Adams, how about Paul?
Paul, as everybody knows, is a reserved gentleman. He is reserved in personal habits. He is reserved in matters legal. As I said before, I think that Paul and I probably were close to the center of the court philosophically. We arrived by different routes. I was just cautious. I think that Paul by nature was reserved and probably philosophically moderately conservative or moderate liberal, whatever you want to call it.
What can you tell me about the fact that, or about the report, let's call it that, that he was kept from one of those vacancies on the court because he, as Attorney General, had been, unfriendly toward the Shoal apportionment initiative. Do you have any knowledge of that?
No. I know that from everything that was said around there that Paul was interested in going to the court, from what was clear from the Williams days and I'm sure from the Swainson days as well. Paul, of course, took the place of Thomas M. Kavanaugh when he assumed that, right?
Oh, let's see. Let me see if I can. He came on once.
Yeah,
in 62.
He took the place of Tom Kavanaugh. No. Wait a minute. No, Paul took the place of George Edwards.
Right. George Edwards.
What I was trying to say was that Paul took the place of Tom Kavanaugh as Attorney General.
Right. That's true. Mm-hmm. And then later on, he was defeated by Michael Hare in 62, but then he came on again in
64.
And
that was because Judge Carr could not run again.
Right. He and Paul,
so Paul ran in the
election.
The last spring election held in Michigan for justices was in the spring of 63, and he was elected quite easily, and he came back on the court first of 64.
It served through the full 8 years of his term, as I remember.
I understand you did, yeah. Yeah, Paul and I were pretty good friends when I had my serious operation for an appendectomy that fouled up and had adhesions, and I was pretty weak coming out of the hospital. When I came by, he took one look at me, he said, go somewhere and get some rest, and he handed me the keys to his cottage on the St. Mary's River, way up north, and I went up there for a week and came back revived, renewed, yeah.
That was interesting.
Yeah.
That is not the image of him that one would get from, the common report about him and the pictures of him. He looks quite to be an austere, ascetic.
I think that he's essentially that, but he's a very gentlemanly kind of person, and he was certainly capable of warm sentiments. And I think that it shines through in some of his opinions. Mm-hmm. He writes with considerable clarity and brevity, as you notice.
I noticed, too, that he is not above a classical allusion now and again in his opinions. He'll pull a text out of one doesn't come to mind right now, Shakespeare or wherever,
yeah.
And he'll find wisdom in that applies to the case.
Yeah, he he's well-read. His wife was a university professor. And, Paul was introduced to, I believe, literature way back in his life, and I think he was always a reader of classical literature.
Well, summing up your experience on the Supreme Court, a man who has had about as full a career as I can really think of in terms of public office, high position in business. Was there anything that you sort of took away from the court that you didn't have before you went there? Some lesson, some inspiration of how to collegiality or that type of thing? Are you had to experience a lot of that prior to the time you got on the court. You were used to that, weren't you, the decision making?
Yeah, with the collegial setting, yeah, I had some experience with that. I guess there's several things that I came away with from the court with. The first thing would be epitomized by that insistence that I of George Edwards that I mentioned before, that we take up the issue now. I found, to my great satisfaction, the people I work with never took any case lightly. Everything was serious. They were damn serious about everything that came up applicationally. They may have had varying degrees of energy with which to tackle it, but nobody gave anything kind of a lick and a promise and sped through it and dismissed it. There was always somebody who would say, "Now wait, now I looked at this with some care and I haven't thought about it," and they would be very, very careful about what they wrote as final precedent. I think we were all aware that the Michigan Supreme Court for 80-90% of all litigation in Michigan is a final word. There are not many federal questions, and with the state law ranging from A to Z, from everything from abandonment, the law of abandonment of vehicles or of children, down to zoning, it's an awful responsibility to have to be the final arbiter of people's disputes in a state, of any state, but a state as large and as complex as Michigan. So it was a great, easy thing to appeal to me to know that they took everything seriously. You might disagree with the result, but they didn't treat anything lightly. I learned, one other thing that might be of some benefit, that is that in a small group of people, such as a court, a collegial court, multi-member court, particularly one where the membership doesn't change. I'm not talking about panels of the circuit court where they're all forever changing, but a court that has the same membership facing each other every day, day in, day out, week in, week out, year in, year out. By the very nature of the beast, so to speak, there will be frictions. And usually the frictions are not so much based upon personal things, but upon, or political things, but upon a kind of observation that you'll make from time to time. You're considering a particular case, and it is approximately what you've had maybe 2 or 3 months before, in principle, you think. And you will think you will know where each justice is going to come out, or where they ought to come out, based upon prior decisions. And what you find is that people don't see precedent the same way. Consistencies, personal consistency, seems to be always in question. And you find that not only in Michigan court, but I noticed that in talking to judges all over the country when I was there, and even since that time, that they'd always find some problem with one of their brethren who could decide Jones versus Brown 3 months before one way, and then decide McCormick versus Hare three months later a different way, when it involved the same principle. The old thing about consistency, and it would trouble people. Not that they were dishonest, but that they didn't see it, or they weren't quite looking at it hard enough or something, and it would sort of trouble the members, and you'd always say, well, why is he doing that? It's a dumb thing, you know. And it came up time and time again, mostly because you view the particular case as one either unlike the case of before or just like it, and you don't know why the other justices decide the way he does, and that causes for some little friction. Another thing I learned about that kind of a close harmony decision process is that even when they were eight, and I'm sure whether it's 9 or 10 or 12 or whatever may be the number, that you change the personnel once, just take one person out, put another in, it changes the whole chemistry. That person brings to the court certain views which are shared in part by some and objected to by others. It brings a certain style, a certain personality, a certain expertise, you might call it, of things that they've done a lot of before, and they have acquired a considerable body of authoritative knowledge about something. That's brought in, that changes the chemistry of the court. But in each time that it changed when I was there, the Supreme Court did, both by the leaving of Edwards, not both, but all the time, but the leaving of Edwards and the coming of Adams, and then the leaving of Adams and the coming of O'Hare, and then the leaving of Carr and the coming back of Adams. That every time that would occur, somebody would leave, somebody else would come on, it would change the temperature of the court a little bit, change the chemistry. The decisional process was affected by one person. I learned that as well.
Is there any sensible way to that you think of to keep the change at a minimum? Or is change of that sort inevitable and valuable? And
I think it's inevitable and probably valuable. I don't know whether it's just I don't think it's something that has to be valuable. It can be destructive, but it's certainly, I don't think there's anything you could do to do it differently, unless you're going to remake people. But.
Or remake the whole system, be like the United States Supreme Court, they're all lifetime, and so you have less change there, presumably. Yeah. It can only occur because of resignation or death rather than for electoral reasons.
Yeah.
Or impeachment.
I rather like the idea that we have here the requirement that you cannot run after 70. There's some few, very few, as you know, exceptional people who have almost their full mental and physical powers after, I won't even say 70, I'll say 65 or 70, but most of them slip a little bit in terms of energy, mental and physical, and you really need the top minds and the top energies for a court. You need experience, of course, but I think the optimum age is about where they put it, and you shouldn't stay around any longer.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. Shall we conclude it on that note, or
sure.
You got something else that maybe ought to be said?
No, just stop it for a while and let me see if I can think of anything else.
This is the end of tape 3 of former Justice Otis M. Smith on October 25th, 1990.